I feel welcome in North Dakota, I can tell you that. Awesome. Wow. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate that great introduction. Let me thank Governor Dalrymple. I appreciate you being here with us and coming out and joining us here this evening. And obviously, you see a couple folks behind me who I'm going to let go off stage because they're going to have to stand here and smile the whole time. So I won't do that to them. But I want to introduce a couple of members of my family who are traveling with me here in North Dakota. We were over in the western part of the state today and got a chance to see the great economic engine of the Bakken, not just for North Dakota, but for this country. And as you know, Karen and I, I've been married. We've been married for 21 years. We are blessed with 7 children. And, you know, thank you. I think if we didn't start with these 2 great kids, we wouldn't have had the rest of them. But they are unbelievable. I'm just so proud of these 2. Have really been great role models for the rest of the kids. And they've been out here. They both took a year off of college to come and be on the road with their dad and help and do some campaigning separately and work in the office and do things to help in any way they can. You know, part of the family business, if you will. And I always say they're 2-fers. They're helping me in 2 ways. Number one, they're free labor on the campaign, which is really good, right? And number 2, I don't have to pay college tuition for either of them this year. So, and this is our oldest. This is Elizabeth, who's my 20-year-old, and John, who's 19. So, thank you, guys. See you, bud. All right. So, the rest of the family is home. I just talked to my wife Karen, and she gives her very, very best. And thank you for this. I said we'd have a few hundred people. I should have said a few thousand people is what I should have said. Unbelievable. And everybody is doing well. I just can't tell you the response I've gotten from folks who've asked about my daughter, Bella, who went into the hospital a couple of weeks ago. And I know so many people have been thinking about her and praying for her. And I just want you to know that she is doing absolutely great. She had a wonderful and full recovery. And I just want from the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for your prayers for little Bella. Thank you. Little Bella and my children are one of the big reasons I'm in this race, because I'm concerned about their future, concerned about the future of our country. With little Bella in particular, I'm concerned about how the rest of this society going forward, particularly with Obamacare, will look at a child that, well, isn't like the rest of us, is seen as something less by too many in our society, and particularly those in positions of power and authority. And I really am concerned as to what this country is going to be like going forward as government starts taking more and more power away from average and ordinary people. I got the opportunity to spend the whole day here in North Dakota and had several opportunities to sit and talk with folks here in Fargo and over in Tioga, and had roundtable discussions with people in the business community, people who are educators. And I kept hearing the same theme over and over again, the concern about the imposition of government and government's will over every aspect of people's lives. No matter what the business is, no matter what aspect of life, it just seemed like this behemoth of a federal government was just growing. Like, I always use movie analogies. My kids always get mad at me. Instead of using like classical literature, I use, you know, movies. And like the Stave Puff Marshmallow Man, and right? It's just, you know, all of a sudden you look at, oh my gosh, look how big this thing is. And that's what government has become. It's this robbing you of your dignity and worth by saying to you that they know better than you do how to run your business, how to run your farm, how to run your life, what kind of insurance you're going to get, what kind of car you're going to buy, what kind of loan you're going to get. People talk about all the big issues in this race, and there are a whole bunch of them. But ultimately, this race is going to come down to the role of government in our lives and who we, what kind of country we want to pass off to the next generation. You see, I believe that America is the greatest country in the history of the world for one reason. For one reason. Because we were founded on the idea that rights did not come from the king. It didn't come from the government or the sovereign. That rights come to us from God. Right? Now, you might find this interesting to know, but there's no other country in the world that was founded with that principle. The Declaration of Independence, which, you know, is not talked about as much as the other document that is in vogue today, and it's an important document, and I'm reaching in my pocket here and pulling this one out. This is the Constitution of the United States. I carry it with me. But with that Constitution, which is vitally important, it is the operator's manual of America. It is the how of America. It's how the government of this country is to function. But the why of America is in the Declaration. The Declaration of Independence, where it said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is what makes America the greatest country in the world. And the Constitution is there to really do one thing, and that's to protect your God-given rights. That's what the Constitution is for. It's a government that's based on this idea that you, the free people of America, can, in working together to build strong families, churches, schools, hospitals, other civic business, small businesses, can build from the bottom up a great and prosperous society. And that government's role is to provide, in a sense, the opportunity for you to be able to do that, to reap the fruits of your labor, to live out your dreams, to do it as a community. You here in North Dakota are probably the best example of any state in the country right now that understands how powerful that vision is and how successful it can be, because that's what you do here. You have strong families and strong communities, tightly knit, interconnected. And as a result, you can survive the good times and the bad times. And I know there have been bad times here. I know that there have been times when you were heavily dependent upon agriculture and things got really tough when ag prices and the dreary days of agriculture. But you hung together. Now you're experiencing the benefits and the fruits of having that belief in free people and free markets and working with the business community, not standing on their necks, not telling them how to run their business, but trusting them that, you know what, they care as much about the air and the water and the land as, well, the people in Washington, D.C. do. In fact, they care more about it here in North Dakota. But you stood by your principles. You stood by the values that made this country and this community a great and prosperous country and community. Well, now there's a group of people in Washington who believe that there's a different way. That you folks, particularly out here in flyover country, right? Out here, that's what they refer to this area, flyover country. Well, we're landing in flyover country, and it's pretty darn nice here, I might add. That you can't be trusted with freedom. You can't be trusted to make decisions for yourself on the complex issues that confront our country. And then we need smart folks, the intellectual snobs in Washington, who believe that they should be able to dictate what is best for you on a whole variety of different things. Folks, that is against everything our country was founded upon. Everything. Our country was founded on the principles that if we believed in free people to go out and, yes, pursue their labors, reap their benefits, but also to provide for themselves and their family and their communities, that we could, in fact, build a just society, and we didn't need government to micromanage how that was done. Well, there's no greater threat to that, in my opinion, the reason I'm in this race, than Obamacare. That is the number one issue, the straw that breaks the camel's back in America. And I got into this race because of my concern, yes, for my little girl who's disabled and how she would be treated under government-run health care and whether they would see her life as valuable as others. But I was also concerned about the rest of my children and the rest of this country because I knew my grandfather and father came from a country that was a top-down dictatorship. It was fascist Italy. My grandfather came here because he wanted a country that believed in him. Even though he had a much tougher life here, he knew that if he worked hard, he sacrificed, that he could create an opportunity for his children and his grandchildren, well, maybe even to run for president of the United States. But Obamacare is a game changer. Obamacare is a piece of legislation that will change how you view the government. Why? Because now you will be dependent upon the government for your health and your life. And everything changes. I want to remind you back when the big controversy over the debt ceiling occurred. And remember, President Obama was fighting to pass a clean debt ceiling just like they're doing now, with no cuts in anything. He didn't want to cut a thing. And the Republicans were saying, nope, we're going to stand firm. They'd never done that before, but this time they were going to stand firm and say, nope, we're going to require reductions in spending because spending was so out of control. And so what did President Obama do when things didn't look good for him? He went out to the American public, stood at a podium, seal of the president, all the trappings, I think he even did it in the east wing of the White House. And he looked into the cameras, looked to the American people. Did he try to say, explain to them all the difficulties and problems and intricacies of what was going on? No, he didn't do that. He didn't inform the American public. Did he try to elevate the debate and talk about lofty things as to what was at stake? No, he didn't do that either. What did he do? He looked into the camera and said, seniors, if you don't call members of Congress right now and tell them to pass this debt ceiling increase, you're not going to get your Social Security check. You're not going to get your Medicare benefit. Veterans, you're not going to get your care. So wives and husbands of men and women in the military, you're not going to get your paycheck. Anybody that had any kind of dependency on Washington, D.C., he pulled the string. And guess what happened? The switchboards were flooded. People were afraid. Why? Because they were dependent upon him and the government. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it won't just be the elderly or the disabled or even the men and women in uniform, or their spouses more specifically. It'll be every single American that he now can go and say, unless you do what I tell you to do, you aren't going to get from me what you need. America is a fundamentally different country once that moment happens. We always talk about almost half the people in this country not paying taxes, and equally almost half receiving some sort of government benefit. Now it'll be everybody in America. Margaret Thatcher, when she left the Prime Ministership of England, said she was never able to accomplish what Reagan accomplished in the 80s, turning back the clock of statism and socialism. and create an opportunity society. And she said, the reason? The British national healthcare system. She couldn't break the dependency. Once a country has socialized medicine, you cut the heart and soul out of America. We cannot let that happen. And the only way to make sure that doesn't happen is that we defeat Barack Obama in this election. We need someone who's going to go out and present a clear alternative vision for our country. It can't be the person who's going to win this campaign in the fall as a Republican is not going to have the most money. Barack Obama's going to have more money. He didn't have to run a primary. He didn't have to spend a penny. All the money he's raising right now, he's saving for the general election and then some. Whoever the Republican nominee is going to come out of here pretty much flat broke. Oh, we'll be able to retool, but no way will we be able to outspend President Obama 4 or 5 to 1 in order to win an election. We're going to have to win an election by working harder, by motivating people who share the same vision, who trust the candidate that they're going to support, that they actually do share the values that you share, and are willing to go out and work. Someone who can go out with less money, with the national media not on their side, who's willing to go out and work hard and going to places like Tioga, North Dakota. Go across this country and deliver a message, reminding Americans how great we really are. And then we don't need him. We don't need somebody who's going to provide for us. President Obama, when he was running for office, would go around the country and talk about hope and change and try to convince the American public that they needed someone that they could believe in. I'm going to go around this country and remind Americans that they need a president who believes in them. We're going to talk about how to do that. We've got to dramatically reduce the size and scale of the federal government now, not later, now. I pledge to you that we put forth a plan. You can look it on the website, but let me go through it real quickly. Here's the bottom line. A lot of folks say, well, you know, you talk about, and we have, cutting $5 trillion over 5 years, balancing the budget in 5 years, supporting a balanced budget to the members of the Constitution that limits federal spending to 18% of the overall economy. By the way, we're at 25% now, which is an all-time high. Over the last 4 years, we've been between 24 and 25%. We have not hit that level ever since World War II, and we've done it now 4 years in a row under this president. So I will talk about cutting spending, but let me just be very specific, because people say, well, what does that really mean, that you want to, you know, cut that much money? Does it mean you're cutting from the rate of growth or the baseline or the, because, you know, Washington accounting isn't like your accounting. All right? So let me just be very clear. In 2013, we will spend less money than in 2012. And in 2014, we will spend less money than in 2013. And in 2015, we will spend less money than in 2014. We will see the government go down. We're serious about this. We're serious. Why? Because it's important. It's important to have a president who understands that with big government comes power over you. Let's take a few examples, since someone in the back wanted a few examples. Let's take one of my favorites, education. Should education be a federal government issue?
No!
Oh, okay, well, that's pretty simple. So what we're going to do is take the federal funding of education. The federal funding of education, which, believe it or not, when I first was elected, about 3% of the overall cost of education, primary and secondary education in America, was paid for by the federal government. It is now 11%. 11%. Anybody see a discernible improvement to the quality of education in our country?
No,
we have not. Money isn't the answer, and more importantly, federal control over states and school districts and parents is not the answer. So what we need to do is take that money and all that money, repeal No Child Left Behind, and get rid of all the federal money that goes to primary and secondary education, and do this. It's not just, see, because that's not going to solve the problem. That's just step one, is to get the federal government out of micromanaging the schools. We need an education system that focuses on this whole concept of bottom up. Who is the customer of the education system in America? The parents. Why? Because it's their responsibility to educate children, right? We've been convinced that somehow it's the government's job. It's not. Now, I will say that Karen and I are homeschoolers, and we've homeschooled for about 15 years. But I'm not suggesting everybody homeschools. What I am suggesting is that we have education policy that focuses in on giving every single child what a parent believes, in consultation with others in the community, what the parent believes is the best possible education for that child. A customized education for every child in America. You say, well, that can't happen. We don't have the money. Wrong. We're just spending the money the wrong way. We're spending on institutions. We're spending on institutions instead of spending it where it needs to be spent, which is to get not just get the federal government out, but let's get the state government out, and let's get it back into the local communities and to the parents to design a system that actually educates the entire child. Now, why do I say that? Look at what No Child Left Behind and all of the effort is done, and when it comes to education in this country, is focused on one thing: academics. Now, academics is important. We need children who get basic information and knowledge and through school. But the idea, how many parents in this room only care about children's academic achievement when you're raising your children? Okay, it's unanimous. I haven't found one. Yet when it comes to our educational system, that's all that they focus on. And that's where the majority of your child's life is spent during the day, most of the year. Wouldn't you like, as parents, wouldn't you like as employers? How many employers out here, how many folks who have ever hired anybody, when you look at someone's resume and you interview them, all you care about is what their grade point average is? No, you don't. I would say most employers maybe look at it, but what do you care about? You care about their character. You care about their integrity, their work ethic, values, virtues. Care about the person. Because of the left and because of government control of education, we've just pushed that all out of the school systems in America. We've said that you can't do that anymore because you're going to offend somebody. So what are we doing? What are we doing with our children? We're putting them into a naked school that focuses on some narrow aspect of their life, instead of putting them in an environment that's rich, that teaches them not just what the ABCs are, but teaches them what it means to be a good citizen, what it means to be virtuous and honest and hardworking. Those are the things that we need to do to transform education. We are never going to succeed in transforming American education, which right now is losing one out of every three children drops out of school before they graduate. We're never going to change that unless we do two things. Number one, engage the parents in the educational enterprise of their children. They must be actively involved. And I say this on behalf of teachers. I say this on behalf of teachers because teachers get a bad rap in this country as the problem in the education system. Most of the teachers will tell you it's the problem is what comes in the door, not what happens while they're inside that door. We need to have parents engaged in the educational system of their children and understand that this is a full-time job working with the educational community. And secondly, we have to create opportunities for children to go to the schools that are best for them in giving them the opportunity to maximize their potential. Now, we can save money. We can save federal dollars. We can improve the education system. That's just one. Let me just take on one other since I don't want to be accused of not being specific. But the biggest problem we're dealing with in this country is not the defense budget. I heard this from the Ron Paul people, so I thought I'd put a little dig in there. The defense budget. Anybody know how much the defense budget was as a percentage of the budget back in 1960? 60%. Smart guy over there. You know what it is now? 17%. So when people say, oh, it's the military-industrial complex that's causing these deficits to be outrageous, it is objectively false. It's objectively false. What was less than 10% of the budget and is now 60% of the budget 50 years later? Entitlement programs. And what soon will consume the entire budget of this country? Entitlement programs. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's one candidate that's been out here that's been specific on how to deal with all of these entitlement programs. He happens to be in Fargo, North Dakota tonight. I support the Paul Ryan plan. I think it's a great start. But he waits 10 years. Did you know that? They wait 10 years for Medicare and Social Security. On the other entitlement programs, they move right ahead, and I agree with what they want to do. They want to cut it, cap it, send all these programs, Medicaid, food stamps, housing programs, get it back to the states, let the states run these programs, give them the flexibility to do it, put time limits on the programs, and put a work requirement on the program. We do those three things. We will save hundreds of billions of dollars over the years if we do that, and we'll have better programs to take care of those in need in society, and we will not treat the poor as a disability that's a permanent condition, but that's a temporary problem that can be and should be and must be transformed so they can move up the ladder. But let me talk specifics about two other programs, Medicare and Social Security, because they are the hot button issues that no candidate would ever touch, or if they do, they wait 10 years to affect. Right? Well, this is smart politically. Folks know now that the retirement age for Social Security is going up, right? It's going up to age 67. Right now, if you retire, you can't take full benefits until you're age 66. Anybody know when that law went into effect? Pretty smart politicians, huh? None of you know. So nobody gets blamed. You know why you don't know? Because they waited 20 years to make the change. They passed a law, and the law didn't take effect until 20 years from then. You know who was the president who was responsible for raising the retirement age? Ronald Reagan. Okay? Most people don't know that. The Gipper was a pretty smart Paul when it all came down to it. Well, he could afford in that respect because we weren't in the deficit situations and the crisis we're in America today. We weren't looking at the entitlement bubble that we're looking at today. Why? Because the baby boom generation started to retire last year. And we went from a few hundred thousand people turning 65 to over a million every year. 1.2, 1.3 million people. We're falling off a demographic cliff. And these programs are going to explode. And we need to do something about it now. How do we do that and not hurt people who are on the margins of society? That's really the question. Because we can't do that. We can't do it and be successful politically, but we can't do it because it's not the right thing to do. So how do we fix these programs? All right, I'll give you two. Medicare first. How many seniors would like to have the same health care plan that members of Congress have? Raise your hand. That's what Paul Ryan's plan does. Paul Ryan's plan is mirrored after the Federal Employees Health Benefit System, which is called a premium support model, which says to every federal employee, including members of Congress, here's how much money we're going to give you. In the case of Medicare, it's a little different. If you're a lower if you're a lower income senior, you get a higher Medicare benefit. If you're a higher income senior, your benefit's a little lower, your premium support. So they give you money. And they say, go out, and you've got a booklet of different plans you can choose from, and you can go out and pick the plan that best suits you. If you want a really expensive plan, you may have to pay a little bit more. If you want a really expensive plan, you may pay a lot more. If you want a plan that's not so expensive, you may not pay anything at all. But then you get to make the decision as to what kind of plan and what kind of system that you have. Everybody has choice. Everybody can customize to what they believe is best for them and their family. That's what members of Congress have. And if we do that and we allow competition among insurance companies, we will see prices go down. We will see the government out of the healthcare business, which it is in right now. It'll be completely out of the healthcare business. So that's how we fix Medicare. We save money and we provide more efficient, cost-effective. We get rid of all the waste. How many seniors get bills that say this isn't a bill and you have no idea what's on the bill, but since you're not paying, Medicare is, well, you know, how are you going to complain that much? Well, now the insurance company is going to be insuring, and they're going to complain if it's not supposed to be on that bill because they're paying the bill. So we're going to have competition out there. Social Security. Let's talk a little bit about Social Security because this is a big deal. Social Security is a real big deal. How do we fix Social Security? Well, let's look at what Social Security is, and let's see what it was when it was founded. Social Security went into effect in 1937. What was life expectancy in 1937? 61. And the retirement eligibility age was set at 65. Everybody thinks Roosevelt was a softy. Who were the lowest income group people in America in 1937 by age group? People over the age of 65. Who were had the least amount of wealth in society by age group in 1937? People over the age of 65. They had a poverty rate of almost 70%, people over 65. Now let's fast forward to today. What is life expectancy in America today? About 80. And the eligibility age is 66. When do most people take Social Security benefits? 62, not 66. For you young people, you didn't know that, did you? Early eligibility is 62. 70% of seniors take their Social Security benefits at 62. How many people in this room believe that someone who's 62 years old is incapable of working? How many think that you're old at 62? Okay, well, there's a guy up front here who does, but he looks like he's lived a pretty hard life, though, so. So, but here we are. 70% of seniors taking Social Security at 62, most of them still working and taking a Social Security benefit. Who are, from the standpoint of poverty rates, who has the lowest poverty rate by age of any group in America? Seniors, 9%. Lowest of any age group in America. Who has the most wealth of any age group in America per capita? Wealth, possessions? Seniors, people over 65. So we talk about changing the Social Security system, and people say, well, we just need to raise taxes on younger workers. Does this really make a lot of sense? It really doesn't. I mean, whether you're a senior or not, it just doesn't make any sense. Did you know that there are 60,000 people in America last year who made over $1 million a year, earned over $1 million a year, and collected Social Security benefits, of which we borrowed money from China to pay them? So here's what there are some things we can do in America today, not 10 years from now, not never. Ryan Plan, by the way, doesn't even talk about Social Security. Why? Because he didn't want to go out and talk about changing Social Security unless he had this conversation first. And the media wasn't going to give him the opportunity to have this conversation. Because now once you understand how the Social Security system was and is, I think you're probably a lot more open to some changes in the system. Right? How many people think it would be a bad idea starting next year, not 10 years, next year, to move the early retirement age for people who are 61 today, to move it to 62 and 1 month? How many people would think that would really upset a lot of 61-year-olds in America? It would have absolutely no consequence at all, but it would save money. And then for 60-year-olds, we move it to 62 and 2 months. And we move it back a month. We've moved the retirement age back, but we haven't moved the early retirement age back. Why don't we do that? I mean, people who are 62 don't need Social Security benefits. And we're borrowing money from China, and we're going to run huge deficits unless we begin to make Social Security fit with where America is today demographically. These are the kinds of things that leaders do. They trust you. They trust you in knowing that if you understand the crisis that we're facing and that we have a shortfall of over $100 billion a year in Social Security now, that we need to make that up, and we need to do it in a way that makes sense, that doesn't hurt anybody. No one in America is going to be hurt decisively by moving the eligibility age back a month or two. These are the kinds of things we're taking or saying to seniors who are very high income that you're not going to get your cost of living benefit this year. These are the kinds of things that are small things but are big things, accumulatively, that can make a real difference. So that's the discussion we need to have. That's what leaders do. They find a common ground. They inform the American public. And then we try to form a consensus going forward. Instead of what this president does, which is routinely defied America every single day. He goes out and pits one group against another. Sets up false premises. You know, I hear this all the time from the president. Well, Republicans don't want to do, and then he'll just pick something outrageous. You know, Republicans want to kill Medicare. How many times do you hear that from somebody? We don't want to do that, but that's what he'll say. Why? Because he wants to divide you. He doesn't want to enable you. He doesn't trust you. He doesn't want to lead you. He wants to command you. He wants to dictate to you because, well, he knows better. Ladies and gentlemen, we have big problems, but these problems are not too big for America. They're not too big for free people to step forward and elect a leader who's willing to lead by getting people together with them so we can do it together as Americans. Folks, at your caucuses on Super Tuesday and at your convention later on, I ask for your help and support. You got a lot of delegates up here in North Dakota for being a small state. You got more than South Carolina, you got more than Iowa, all those quote important states. you've got more bang for your buck up here in North Dakota. All right? You go out and give us that opportunity. You give us that lift on Super Tuesday with a big win here in North Dakota. We will take that, and I will go across this country and make Barack Obama the issue in this election, stand for the values of free enterprise, faith, family, life, the values that made this country the greatest country in the history of the world, a strong America with a strong national security, a strong military. We will make this race about two visions for America. One that believes in those core values that built the greatest society in the history of the world, and one that is modeled after the failed state after failed state of what's going on in Europe and what went on before that with all these other attempts at government control of people's lives. You give us that opportunity. You take those final words in the Declaration of Independence, where those signatures of the Declaration pledge their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor. They did so at a time when they were probably signing, they thought they were signing their death warrant. America had a ragtag army of volunteers led by a great man, but didn't have any of the skills, didn't have any of the weaponry that the British had, or the power or the money. And yet they signed that document. They signed their lives right there. And these were people of means. They weren't the riffraff of society and people with nothing to lose. They had everything to lose. They were the leaders. They were the business people. They were the community leaders. They were the preachers. They had families. And they were willing to risk everything to establish a country that believed in God-given rights and free people. Everybody does. Everybody does. So I'll ask you not to give up your lives, but thank God every single day in America, men and women put a uniform on and risk their lives every day to defend this country and defend those rights. And I'm not going to ask you for your fortune. Although if you do go to ricksantorum.com, little bit of, you know, just a little bit of your fortune would be nice. But I am asking you to put your honor on the line. Because in a sense, every generation has a duty to hand to the next generation something better than they were given. You do in each one of your families. You think about what shoulders you stand on in your family, and whether you're able to give to your children at least something as good as what you were able to provide, your parents were able to give you. We all feel that obligation as parents. Well, you feel the same way as stewards of a great inheritance in North Dakota and in this country. And that's where your honor comes in. You have the honor to say after a life well lived that you did your duty, that you upheld the honor of your family and of your community and of your country. And this is a time where, well, that honor is really at stake, because this country and what its founding principles are really at stake. And so I ask each and every one of you to do your duty, to make the sacrifices for freedom. That's why I ask for your help and support. You have an opportunity on a very important day very important day in this country in the nomination process for president to speak loudly, clearly, convincingly as to the person that you want to lead this country. And I hope you guys were a little ahead of me on that one, but since you guys already got the point, I'll stop and be happy to take a few questions. How's that? We got a microphone here that can take questions. Greg, here we go. Got it. Thank you, Gary.
Questions?
Either raise your hand. Gary will be happy to. There's folks over here. Want to get people there? Yes.
Strong tradition of military defense. We were among the first to have an anti-missile in Grand Forks. We had many strong decades of the Strategic Air Command in front of the unmanned vehicle and the remote control piloting program.
Right.
What is your big challenge regarding missile defense?
I have been a stalwart supporter of missile defense and Star Wars, whatever you want to call it, from way back when, and even more so now. I mean, I can't say that I was quite the visionary of Reagan who understood the importance of space when I was younger in politics, although I supported missile defense. You know, I supported it because it made sense, but now it's clear that is the greatest threat to our country from a standpoint of a foreign attack other than terrorism is a missile being launched at the United States, particularly, as I'm sure you folks are familiar with the electromagnetic pulse and what that could do in a sense wiping out the electric grid and everything else in this country that is powered by electricity. And that is a serious threat. It's one that the Congress has studied that most people don't talk about, in addition to other types of obviously ballistic missiles that could be aimed here. But an EMP is a weapon of terror. It's not one that necessarily is concerned about from another country being launched, you know, ballistically, but being able to defend any kind of missile attack from in or around the perimeter is also as important as it is in space. So we've got real challenges and with limited resources. But that's why I said that I will not cut the defense budget. We need to make sure that area of the government, which is the principal purpose of the federal government, is to defend this country. It's something that no state or local government can do. It's something that the community can do. You can't do bottom-up defense in the world today. It's one of those top-down things. And it's the one thing that, it's interesting, it's one thing our founders gave the federal government. They got it right because the federal government does defense pretty darn well. We don't do much else well. But we do defense well. We have a great culture that was built over time. And we continue to maintain that culture as best we can. And we need to continue to support our defenders. And here's where the president comes in as commander-in-chief. Served 8 years on the Armed Services Committee. I've been very, very involved in defense issues for a long time. And I understand the importance of having a robust military across the board, particularly, as you mentioned, in space, but also, you know, with our Navy, which is... Really, I'm very concerned about the state of our Navy right now and the number of ships we have and the capability and our ability to be able to protect this country here, as well as to have that forward deployed capability that carriers and carrier groups can give us. So we've got a lot at stake, and that's why as we cut that budget year after year after year, defense will not be cut, and depending on the contingencies that we're dealing with, we will put the resources there that are necessary to make sure that our country is safe.
We have and about the shortage of jobs, and Obama came out with those new statistics, and they look pretty good, but if he hasn't, I don't think, used all the figures that he's using. But my question for you is, if we are short on jobs now, what happens when these military boys come home from service and overseas? What are we going to do for jobs for them?
Yeah. Well, number one, I oppose President Obama's cuts in the military, A. B, I oppose his cuts in troop complement. I don't believe that we need to be shrinking our military, particularly at a time when you see so many who are deployed 5, 6, 7 times. And now we're going to cut back the number of troops. So what, they're going to be deployed 8, 9, 10 times? This is not fair to the people who are making this great sacrifice that we have less opportunity for those rotations. So again, that will be one of the big differences you'll see between me and frankly the other President Obama and frankly the other candidates who have said that defense is on the chopping block. It is not, and will not be. And we're going to keep that troop complement up and maybe even expand it. I know the Marine Corps doesn't want to get any bigger because they're a small force and they like to be about that size. But there may be other areas, particularly in the Army and maybe even the Navy, that we need a more robust complement. So we're not doing to our men and women what we've been doing over the past 10 years. We are so many of our men and women are coming back having served, and in these repeated hostile environments, and they're coming back wounded, not just wounded from the standpoint of physical wounds, which certainly a lot of them are, but you know the PTSD that we're seeing and the stress that you know, living in countries and repeatedly going back and forth into two different worlds, and a world where, you know, who knows who the enemy is every day, is a very, very tough thing psychologically on people. And the more of these rotations, the higher incidence we're going to get of this disorder. And we just shouldn't be doing that to our men and women in uniform. So we're going to be very careful about the deployments that we have, and we're going to make sure that we are not going to be stretching our military as we have in the past 10 years.
Hi, I'm Lowell Call from Harvey, North Dakota, and you bottom up. How does that compare against trickle down?
Well, I mean, I was not someone who would ever use the term trickle down, because what the government's role is to create a platform of opportunity for people to be successful in America. If you want to get down to another real distinction about a Santorum administration and an Obama administration, it's equality of opportunity versus equality of result. And President Obama, when he was running for the Senate, I believe, said that the one change he would make in the Constitution is he would pass a constitutional amendment or promote a constitutional amendment that would allow the government to redistribute wealth. That's what the president believes. He believes that the government is there to make things equal. You will never hear me talk about income distribution as a problem in America. There will be people that make more, there will be people make less, and that's the way America's always been and hopefully will always be. That's okay. What I talk about is income mobility, the ability to rise in society. That means government is creating a platform or a playing field that gives everybody an opportunity to climb the ladder of success. That's what the government should be. We should be setting the rules and regulations. We should be setting the laws that maximize freedom and opportunity, that give everybody, for example, those who are who've fallen, and we all fall. I mean, everybody here has had their struggles and failures. And sometimes, yes, we need a little extra help, and a government program may be necessary. But that program should be one that, from the day you are on it, is anticipating you're getting off, and it's just a temporary help for you to move through that phase in your life. We have a president who believes that you can tell the success of his presidency by how many more people that government spends money on. And that's just the wrong calculus. It should be the opposite. The greatest success we could have is that we don't need any more welfare programs, that everybody's working in America. I don't know. Where's Greg? Is he over here?
Right here.
All right. Gary?
Hi, my name is Greg Mall, and I'm from Moorhead, Minnesota, which is actually across the river, so I'm cheating. But
you guys in Minnesota did okay by me, so you can ask me for it. It's all right.
My question, or actually my concern, is Obama has distanced America from Israel more than any president in the United States history, which is how would you support Israel as our most important ally in the Middle East, especially in the current state where Iran is literally saying we want to wipe every Jew and Christian off the earth? Thank you.
I think you framed the question perfectly. The President of the United States has been the most hostile president since the creation of the State of Israel toward the State of Israel. He has systematically isolated Israel, and the way he has dealt with housing developments, characterizing housing settlements in Jerusalem as the Palestinians would, as somehow problematic that they can't build in their capital. These were not buildings and settlements out on the West Bank. This was in Jerusalem. And you go on top of that of how he handled the embargo, where there were obviously people trying to break the embargo, and the Israeli troops did what they had to do to enforce their embargo. President didn't side with them. President didn't side with Israel's friend, Hosni Mubarak, in Egypt, in spite of the protestations of the Israelis, that this would create a destabilization in the region and end up with the Muslim Brotherhood in charge of Egypt. President didn't care. He was going to encourage and invite an Arab Spring, a Muslim Spring, which is turning into a winter for Israel. You throw on top of that what just happened recently with the President and the Secretary of Defense revealing what I assume was intelligence that Israel was in the process of planning attacks this spring to take out nuclear facilities in Iran. Why would a friend, why would a close ally reveal sensitive information, and in revealing so, condemn Israel and hold them up for scorn for the rest of the world? Do friends do that? No, they don't. But yet, they continue, the president continues to isolate Israel. At the very same time, you saw the chief mullah, the grand ayatollah, refer to Israel as a cancer last week that must be excised. It's not the first time they've done this. They do it repeatedly. They talk about how we have to get rid of the great Zionist threat, the little Satan. We are the great Satan. And somehow or another that, you know, if we let them get rid of the little Satan, they won't pay any attention to the great Satan. President Obama has done more to destabilize and create security threats for the nation of Israel than any president. I will do just the opposite. I've a long track record of focusing on helping the state of Israel, supporting them in every possible way, because they are a good and key and strategic ally for our country. And I also have been very clear about focusing on Iran. For almost 10 years, I have been sounding the alarm that Iran is the biggest problem in the Middle East. Barack Obama 4 years ago called them a little country that we don't have to be concerned about. That's what he said. This is how prescient our president is in looking at the world, that he takes Iran and throws them off as a trifle. And now everyone, Democrat and Republican, see this as the number one threat to the stability and security of not just the Middle East, but the world. And the president got it wrong. I know he got it wrong, because when I had a bill that dealt with trying to put sanctions on the Iranian nuclear program. Back in 2006, President Obama voted against it. And you know who led the charge against it on the floor? Joe Biden. Surprise? I always tell people, if you ever want to know what position to take on any national security issue, find out what Joe Biden thinks and do the opposite. But I have been very clear, Iran cannot get a nuclear weapon. My hope is that by January 20th, 2013, that has not happened yet. But I fear, given the way the Israelis are behaving, that they may know more information and that that day may come quicker. And if this president, and he seems to intent in doing so, allows that nuclear explosion to occur and that capability to be had, he will have degraded the security of our country greater than any president in recent memory. He will have taken America and put it on the chopping block. General Clapper, as I mentioned the other day, says that Iran is planning all sorts of attacks in this country. Imagine now a nuclear Iran with no fear that the United States or any country will attack them because no nuclear power has ever been attacked. Imagine what they will do in terrorism with impunity. Imagine what is in store for the state of Israel with Hezbollah and Hamas, who want to destroy and eliminate that state. And where will the world be? The world that constantly criticizes Israel and questions their existence. You know that Tehran routinely holds Holocaust denial conferences every year. Every year. They hold conferences about how the Holocaust didn't occur. And of course, we make fun of it. Oh, you know, these are just these crazy folks. You ask the question in the Middle East whether the Holocaust occurred, and a majority of the people in the Middle East do not believe it happened. It's the power of propaganda. It's the power of wanting to believe what you want to believe. And if you, of course, don't believe the Holocaust happened, then what is one of the major justifications for the state of Israel's existence in the first place? Folks, this is a president that has lit the fuse. We better have a president that can snuff it out before this bomb explodes.
Senator, North Dakota is a pro-life state. We have a pro-abortion president. Some observations earlier about your stance and the stage of development. Please share that with the rest of the crowd.
I'm very proud. People say, you know, Rick, are you the social conservative candidate in the race? And I make the stance that, well, if that's what people want to call me, I'll very happily accept that moniker, because I do believe that the moral cultural issues are very much and very important to the foundation of our country. And if you, not just, we can't have a strong society without strong families. If families break down, society breaks down. And I talk about it in terms of economics. That way, some of our more moderate folks on social issues can understand why those of us who are passionate about this from a moral point of view also are passionate about it, because we understand the consequences to America if families are not formed. And if you look at the consequence of families not forming in America, you have the poverty rate among single-parent families in America approaching 40%. Two-parent families, it's 8%. You look at the consequence of families not forming. 30 years ago, 71% of Americans over the age of 18 were married. Now it's 51%. 30 years ago, there were 250,000 people in prison in America. Now there are 2.5 million people in prison in America. Why do I mention that number? Because 70 to 80% of the people in prison grew up without a father in the home. You break down the family in America, you undermine traditional marriage, you destroy any opportunity for a free, safe, and prosperous America long term. You can't. That's why I wrote a book called It Takes a Family. I wrote a book called It Takes a Family because I believe all our public policy should be in place to support the family in America. If you look at Obamacare, you are thousands of dollars better off under Obamacare if you cohabitate as opposed to being married. It is incredible. All of these government programs. If you're married, you get less than if you're living separate. I had one man tell me just the other day that he was, well, actually today in Tioga, who told me that he was married and taking care of his wife who needed to be put on Medicaid, and the government basically advised him that, well, he makes too much money and that he should divorce. If he divorced, he would get all sorts of government benefits. This is the government of the United States, folks. Out there saying that we'd be better off all by yourself. Well, that way, you're going to be much more dependent upon them, aren't you? People think that, oh, well, this is just benign. This is not really people who want to destroy the institutions of our society, like faith and family, in order to have people out there by themselves being more and more dependent upon government. Oh, really? I do believe that. I do believe there are some who see that as a preferential society. We need to have someone who's going to be willing to stand up and fight for the family and to fight for life. People ask me all the time, do you think God, because, you know, I'm very public about my faith. And they say, do you believe, because I've said that I don't believe that God will continue to bless America if we continue to kill 1.2 million children every year in this country. And the media always asks me, do you really believe that? She said, do you really believe that? I said, well, do you think God is going to bless America no matter what we do? No. Do you believe that? I asked them back. I said, do you believe that no matter what we do, that God will bless America? And at some point, even those who may not agree with on the issue of abortion will say, well, yeah, I guess there's probably at some point, you know. But most of them don't really think that really is happening anyway. They just say it. You know, God bless America. You know, it's just sort of a thing you say, but not really mean. See, I mean it. I want God to bless America. Here's the reality of the situation. We need a candidate. People say, well, are you too conservative on the social issues? Well, if you look at the other candidates in the race, they have the same position on the social issues that I do. The same position. President Obama and I have the same position on marriage. I don't know if you knew that or not. That's what he says. That's what these other guys say. So why am I the guy if all the other ones have the same position on marriage and family now? And life now, I underscore now, then why am I the social conservative candidate who's too conservative to be elected because I'm a social conservative, if they have the same positions I do? Could it be that maybe some of you don't think that they actually have those positions? Could it be that they don't talk about those things? Could it be that they're uncomfortable talking about those things? So, who do you want to elect? Do you want to elect someone as president? And who do you want to put up as your nominee? Someone for independent voters. People who may not agree with us on these issues. Now, we all have the same position. Someone who doesn't agree with us on these positions. Who looks at the three or four candidates and says, well, we maybe feel more comfortable with them because they don't believe what they're actually saying? Or voters going to say, well, you know, we don't agree with them, but at least we know that the guy here in Fargo tonight actually believes what he says, so we sort of trust him that he's going to do what he says he's going to do. And I may not want him to do that on this issue, but I want a president I can trust. And on the issue of life, I will make the case, because it is essential for our country to understand that, unlike some of these other candidates who say they believe life begins at conception, I do not believe life begins at conception. I know life begins at conception. How do I know? How can we know this? Because it is a biological fact. It is not, you know, it's the old idea that everybody's entitled to their opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts. And when the left says, oh, the Republican Party, you conservatives are the anti-science party. Oh, really? You create this fiction that life in the womb isn't life, when in fact it is a human being at the moment of conception, and it is alive. It is by definition of human life. And so, if you want to make the claim that that human being isn't entitled to protection under the Constitution, go ahead, make it. Go ahead, make it that we're going to treat human life at different stages differently under the law. And then see where that takes us, where it is taking us. I remind you of one thing that Barack Obama said, then I'm going to finish up because Kevin's getting real nervous behind me. One thing that Barack Obama said when he was a state senator, it was a bill called the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. And I know this issue very well because I was the author of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. And I worked on it with a professor by the name of Hadley Arkus, and Hadley came up with this legislation. We did, and I introduced it, and we passed it. It passed unanimously in the House and Senate and was signed. It was unanimously that any child born who is born alive is entitled to appropriate medical attention. Why? What was happening in states of children who were born alive as a result of an abortion, botched abortion? They were thrown in trays and put in the dump in the garbage can, alive. They were not treated at all. And so we put a law in place that said, no, you can't do that anymore. You're going to be criminally charged if you do that. Now, to my knowledge, there was only one place where there was an active debate on this issue. It was in the state of Illinois, where a certain state senator took to the floor and argued against passing that bill in the state of Illinois. And made the argument. He said, a baby fetus, whatever you want to call it. That's his words. He made the argument that if he voted to give rights to that child born as a result of a botched abortion alive, that would undermine Roe versus Wade. And that he could not support any bill that gave any rights to a child prior to 40 weeks of gestation. Now think about what that says. That according to Barack Obama, Senator Barack Obama, any child born before 40 weeks is subject to be killed if the parent doesn't want that child, in his logic. Now, how can anyone call any of us extremists given this man, in a public setting, argued for infanticide for any child born in America prior to 40 weeks gestation, prior to term? We should have known how radical this man was by his views prior to electing him. But now we know. We don't have to speculate anymore. It is now our obligation to stand up, put your honor on the line, make a difference over these next few weeks. Sign up on our website, ricksantorum.com. Go to those caucuses and give us a resounding victory. Those of you who can be delegates at the state convention, go help us get those delegates. We will make this election about what kind of America you and your children want to leave to the next generation. And we will win a great victory for freedom in America. Thank you and God bless. Hold on 1 second. I didn't know we had these jerseys. Scott Hanna and I were talking on the way over, and I congratulated him because I understand that you have a pretty good football team here. And I just wanted to put on the congratulate the North Dakota State University Bisons for their great year. And I understand the coach is here. Is that true? The coach?
We want more. We want more.
Is he here? No? I got bad info? All right. It was just, if he was here, I was going to ask for an endorsement. But, all right. And I understand there's another team here that I understand... I understand has a pretty good hockey team this year. And I sort of like that logo. What do you think, guys? So I want to wish them the best of luck and have a great year in North Dakota and give us a big win. Thank you.